Today, I have a discussion with David Ritter, the CEO and co-founder of PrivacyLock. I met David in 2017 while we were working in China on a blockchain project together. David is an insightful, astute, and measured human being who sees things for what they are. I really enjoyed working with David, and I really enjoyed our conversation about his journey from his early days when he first graduated university to now co-founder for PrivacyLock. I think you will find this conversation very interesting if you're interested in the fintech space and certainly in the blockchain space. Please enjoy my conversation with Mr. David Ritter. So why don't we kick it off? So David Ritter, introduce yourself. I've known you for a few years, and we've been out of touch for a while. So we'll do all the catch up. But just what's the meet and greet version of David Ritter these days?
The meet and greet version of me, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me onto the podcast. I'm really excited about this. As you mentioned, you and I have known each other for many years. Last time we met, I was running a blockchain startup based in Shanghai. Of course, we were doing stuff all over the place, including in Australia. And since then, I moved back to the US, and we exited that company and began a new company focused on data privacy and data protection. So I look forward to talking about that with you. And I know that you're very keen on the blockchain Web3 space, so you'll be happy to know that our new startup, it also includes blockchain technology and Web3-enabled approach to solving some of these issues.
Okay, fantastic. All right, we'll dig into that. Can we go back a little bit? So one of the things that really endeared you to me was this deep appreciation of not only, you were the most polite individual I had dealt with in a long time. So power to you, buddy. But I found so we were working in Shanghai. We met in Shanghai, and there was so what led you to work in China in the first place as a Yankee Doodle Dandy American or all American lad.
Yeah. Okay. So you want to get deep into the history of
just to provide some context and how I found this American guy wandering around the halls of these Shanghai offices.
Well, I'll try to keep this as brief as I can. But basically, I graduated from university in 2007, and that was when the recession began. So right. I was sort of faced with this choice to sort of scrape my way through the recession as somebody who was just entering the workforce, or to try something different. And I had taken a couple years of Mandarin Chinese in school, and I thought, it would be interesting to go out to China, really learn the language,
sure,
and then hone that as a skill that I could use for business. And when I went out to China, of course, I don't know how many of your listeners know this, but during the recession in the West, most economies in the Western world were impacted heavily by the recession. China was booming, and there was tons of cash, and there was tons of job opportunities, and foreigners like myself from all over were able to get into China with relative ease. It's very different today, and to find good paying jobs. So for me, I came to China, I taught some English, I was learning the language, and then I sort of, just by chance, found an opportunity in the financial services sector. So I started working for an American company that had come to China in search of capital to build a project in the US, based in Florida. And this became kind of this boutique finance industry. Are we good?
Yeah, no, we're good. Sorry, I just switched on the recording because I captured some stuff for social media. So just keep talking and I'll talk to you about it later.
Oh, I got it. Well, so anyway, I kind of fell into this world of boutique finance. And what we were doing was, again, during the recession, there was such limited access to capital for project developers that the smart ones started to look abroad. Mm-hmm. And there was tons of cash in certain parts of the world, like Southeast Asia and maybe the Middle East and other places. So I was working in the Asian region, and these project developers would come, and they would hire me to help them raise funding, specific types of funding. And the one that we specialized in at the time was called EB-5, which was a boutique financial product that was like a fast track green card. Mm-hmm. And so this may sound somewhat familiar to you because Australia had a similar immigration investment program. New Zealand had one. The U.S., several European companies like Malta had a robust program.
Yeah.
And it was way where the government was incentivizing foreign capital to come into the U.S. And the hook was you get a fast track green card.
Yep.
So the government still processed the green card that you invest. Now, what it meant from a financial perspective was a really good hook for people to invest into the U.S. during the recession. And we were mostly doing real estate. And mm-hmm. Asian investors tended to like U.S. dollar-denominated real estate opportunities. So it was kind of a good mixture of opportunity, good timing with the recession, and there was tons of cash in China and other Asian countries at the time. And so this industry sort of exploded overnight, and I found myself right place, right time, worked for several companies along the way, and ultimately was hired by a Chinese private equity firm. And Chinese private equity was kind of maturing at the same time to continue doing this work, which is right before I met you. Mm-hmm. So I'm getting towards the original question here. But so for about 4 years, I worked for this Chinese private equity firm. We specialize in packaging immigration investment plus other sources of capital. So it became more sophisticated.
Right.
And we invest primarily in the US and Australia, in Melbourne in particular.
God's own city. God's own city.
That's right. Now, my portfolio was the US portfolio, as you can tell from my accent. And so we did this until about 2018. But what happened was in 2016, the economies in Asia started to slow down.
Right.
And so whereas they kind of had the upper hand during the recession and had this ability to invest in and claim ownership of assets in the US, Australia, and elsewhere, now the economy was slowing in China, and the government there and in other Asian countries became concerned with capital flight. So they turned off the money tap, basically, mm-hmm. and it really curtailed our business model. And so I started looking for something else.
Right.
And that something else for me was this passion for Web3, blockchain technology, cryptocurrencies, which in 2017 was just starting to have a boom, you might remember.
Yeah.
And this led me ultimately in 2018 to find my partners and we formed the Penta Network.
Right, right. I think we drank the Kool-Aid for blockchain and crypto around the same time. So yes, I do recall. I remember the Penta business quite well, but that's had a journey itself, which then led to your current business, or is it a fork effectively? You've got Penta and you've also got your current business. Do you want to explain that?
No pun intended, right, Peter?
Right. That's right. No pun intended.
There's definitely connection. Very, very different business. But what we were doing with Penta Network was building a layer one blockchain, which was very, which was where the industry was in 2017, 2018. People were trying to build these layer ones. So for your listeners, if anybody's paid attention to the blockchain world and the crypto markets, then most of the big cryptos you've probably heard of, Ethereum, and Bitcoin and Cardano and et cetera, these are layer one blockchains. And they're kind of the core infrastructure that other projects were on top of, whether that's a crypto project.
It's a railway track.
It's a railway track. Yeah, exactly. So we were building one of those, and our experience was from the bank tech space.
Yep.
And here's where I'll connect my dots to privacy law. But in the bank tech space, we were working, our partners who sponsored our project, they were working in tax technology. So what we call regulatory technology or reg tech. So yep. we were delivering reg tech to banks, primarily American and European banks, who were opening up regional offices across Asia. And I was still working out of Shanghai. And we were selling them tax technology. And then my company with Penta Network, we were selling them Web3 enablement. So we were building a layer one blockchain, and that was our core product, but we were selling blockchain enablement to banks. So we built projects for Morgan Stanley and Standard Chartered Bank, and Bank of China, we had a pilot with them. So we did a lot of interesting things and ultimately exited from that business and then cast our eyes in a new direction, which is what ultimately became Privacy Lock.
Right. Okay. So Penta's still up there as a website, but is it active business still?
I would say it's not particularly active at the moment. I mean, the technology is still there.
Yep.
The crypto is still active in some markets, and we're waiting to see what happens next. But I'm no longer involved directly with sure. what's happening with them.
So would you say that, because obviously the only use case, or the main use case that blockchain gave birth to was really money, and that's Bitcoin. A lot of the other blockchain projects have had various levels of utility and I guess value to the corporations. Most of them have been in the experimental space. Have you seen anything that really nailed a use case that's not Bitcoin and money?
This is a great question. At the outset, let me say, I believe strongly, and my partners and I share this belief, that there are some really strong use cases for blockchain technology. And just as a reminder, blockchain is one form of a larger technology, right, which is distributed ledger technology. And in particular, we see use cases, valuable use cases for blockchain and distributed ledger tech, DLT, that is in the data and regulatory space.
Right.
So we, you know, to your point, Peter, most of the use cases we've seen so far are about digital assets, like cryptocurrency. Is it, you know, digital versions of commodities, mm-hmm. digital versions of securities,
right,
and then facilities like Bitcoin, which could be considered a currency. So digital versions of currency, and there's no doubt that that was the original, quote unquote, killer app for right. for blockchain technology. Looking further afield, I think the future of blockchain is going to I mean, I don't think that Bitcoin's necessarily going to go away anytime soon, but I think there's also potentially a larger use case for Bitcoin to play in the data world. And as we think about this emerging concept that we call Web3, it's not just blockchain and distributed ledger technology, it's IoT devices, it's AI, new AI programs like LLMs, it's AR and VR. It's all these new technologies that are sort of happening at the same time. And privacy, I think, fits into the story. We can talk about that in a moment. But just to sort of round out the point here, I think that what all of this leads to with Web3 is more machine-to-machine interaction.
Yep.
And in a world where so much of business and consumer opportunity, you know, consumer decisions and products are part of a machine-to-machine process, then how do you trust what happens at the end of that process? How do you trust that the product you're getting, let's say I buy a pharmaceutical from an online pharmacy, well, how do I trust that I'm actually getting what I paid for and it's actually going to solve my problem?
Yep.
And I'm not just getting snake oil, right?
Yep.
And I think this is where blockchain has a role to play in distributed ledger tech, because we need to build trust into Web3 data systems. So that's where I think yep. a huge use lies. And this can apply in different ways, whether it's digital identity, which is a huge problem, and I think it has been a third rail for a lot of blockchain companies, but also when it comes to consumer safety, consumer privacy, which we'll talk about, and ways to build data systems that are efficient, but accountable and trustable.
I think you're on point. You're absolutely right in the sweet spot, as far as I'm concerned, with regards to the whole DeFi space. And in my mind, it's kind of like where finance started, where everything was a bearer asset or a derivative thereof, but it was something I held. I held gold, I held silver, I secured it myself, I jumped on my horse, I went from point A to point B and I did a deal and we counted out the money or we lent against it or whatever the deal was, but it was very much a self-custody world back in the day. Then we went into this custodial service, this trusted third party world, this economy over the last few hundred years, and that may be coming to an end, but at the very least, it is now the two systems. So now that you've got digital bearer assets and digital bearer derivatives, effectively financial assets that you can then go lend against, insure, and get a yield on. the two systems need to interoperate. The two systems need to kind of find that sweet spot where they can talk to each other, TradFi, DeFi, and do everything that we need to do, tax, regulatory compliance, obviously maintain self-custody, because if people now don't trust the trusted third party as much, well then they're saying, well, okay, I see what happens in a whole bunch of different areas. I need to control my asset. I need to give myself comfort that if I am going to get a benefit from this asset that I've accumulated, I'm not putting myself at an unnecessary risk to bad policy or nefarious actors. So that's what I'm hearing. But in that those various spaces that you're talking about, I want to going back to the entrepreneurial bit. At what point did you go, I can do some of this stuff for myself. I don't need an employer. Was there a point which you thought, okay, I'm gonna put my foot in the world where I'm managing my own cash flow, and somebody else doesn't have to worry about paying me.
Oh man, I guess I would say that I often ask myself the same question. Here I am with my second company, and you know, being a founder of a startup is a challenge. Even as a second-time founder, it's a real challenge, because the thing that's most important to me, obviously, I really care about the industry we're in. We believe in our product. I love my team, and being able to build a company that can sustainably support jobs and give people a growth in their own careers is always front and center in my mind. And so that's the thing that I think is incredibly challenging, is wanting to get somewhere economically and product wise with your business, but figuring out how to bring the people along with you and to build a community around a product. And that word community, I guess, is also very much a Web3 blockchain type word, where we have to not just create a product and sell it into the marketplace, but build a community around that. I think that's very typical of modern commerce, where you build, you know, bulletin boards and comments into social media and social media presence. And in a way, all of this is building community that connects back to products and services. But part of that community is the people who are on the team. And that's the most important thing to me. So I don't know when I decided, I guess, it was after I left my stint in private equity. I was looking for something else. I was intrigued by the opportunity to do something entrepreneurial. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that I'm going to do it a third time. This may be my. Hopefully, I'll put everything into this one, and we'll build a nice, beautiful ecosystem around this company, and that'll be.
Be careful! Be careful what you say. I thought I was done and dusted, but really not.
it can be a bug. It's like travel, right? You get the travel bug, and you just want to travel.
Absolutely,
more.
Absolutely. And I had a lecturer when I did my master's who he said to me, Pete, there are only two ventures that you need to get right. The first one, because that's gonna hook you, and the last one, because that's gonna retire you. The rest don't really matter.
No, I like that. There's a lot of truth in that.
Absolutely. So let's talk. Let's talk about Privacy Lock. I was surprised when I read your bio that really you've had a lot of experience in, obviously, technology for financial companies, tax compliance, multinational banks. So tell us how Privacy Lock, was it? How did it come about? Did it come to you, or did you go to it?
Well, I think it was a combination of both. We had we'd finished our work with Penta, my partners and I, Steve and Ed. Ed, who's down under, based in Melbourne, and then Steve, my partner, who worked with us at Penta, was a co-founder, lived in Melbourne at the time, but has since repatriated himself to the United States and is now living in Seattle. So shout out to my partners, who are wonderful.
Yeah.
And we weren't done with distributed ledger technology.
Yep.
And I'm saying that instead of blockchain, because we have since experimented with a lot of different versions of distributed ledger tech. And we still believe, coming back to one of your early questions, that there are really great use cases that people haven't really unlocked for distributed ledger technologies. And one that we see is RegTech, coming back to this idea of regulatory technology and building trust into systems where as we scale, as we scale as a global, you know, consumer marketplace, we're going to be relying more and more on machine-to-machine interactions. And so we have to trust data. We have to build trust in the data systems, and we have to build, and once we can do that, then we can have trusted decision-making processes that may be some combination of machine-to-machine and machine-to-human. And I think this is very much the world that we're moving towards. So what kind of caught our attention as we were thinking about what to do, and we had dabbled in supply chain, and we had done some stuff, in other regulatory spaces. We were kind of doing supply chain RegTech at the time. But we saw that this new law in Europe had taken hold. That was the General Data Protection law, GDPR. And for us, it was a game changer.
Explain it a bit? Because I know about GDPR. I don't know what the big deal is. So can you give us a quick explanation?
GDPR is really a landmark piece of legislation. It's the General Data Protection Regulation, and it's a privacy law. Mm-hmm. What it really is a data regulation law, is how I look at it. So when we use the word privacy, it has broad definition and broad context. So let me explain what that means. What GDPR does is it regulates the way that businesses are allowed to collect, process, share, and reuse data about its consumers. And very much as if I were to put it into Web3 language, I would say in the Web2 era, us as consumers, we were the product. Mm-hmm. You know, platforms monetized us by monetizing our data without our consent.
Right.
And GDPR is an answer to that. And in a Web3 way, it's about giving access and ownership of data back to the consumer who generated the data. And GDPR laid down some pretty strict requirements for what you're allowed to, in what cases you're allowed to collect without consent, mm-hmm. in which cases you must require consent from a consumer. Mm-hmm. And after the data has been collected, how do you manage it? Are you allowed to just keep the data? And what GDPR does is it actually gives, as I think of it, a bill of rights mm-hmm. to European consumers to go to businesses that have collected your data and say, I want you to delete my data, or I want you to tell me what data you've collected about me and give me access to my own data. It's called an access request.
Okay.
So GDPR lays out all these rules and requirements. And from a very high level perspective, what it does is it transforms the way that businesses are now able to collect, process, manage, and derive value from consumer data.
Wow.
So GDPR was this gold standard piece of legislation, and now we're seeing it spread worldwide. It wasn't the first piece, but for our intents and purposes, the most critical one. Canada has a national law. I know that Australia has a privacy law. I think that's been on the books from the 1980s. I'm not an expert.
Written with a quill. It was. It might not be fit for purpose now. But so I guess that you're kind of answering what I was going to say. So are the Americans, the Australians, the rest of us, we're following suit with something similar? Are we cut and pasting the GDPR laws and kind of making them our own, or is everyone kind of configuring it slightly differently?
Look, from a legalese perspective, that's probably a question better answered by a lawyer. What I can say is, in many countries, like the laws we're seeing in the U.S., which right now are state by state, we don't have a national data privacy framework or regulation. But many countries do. Canada has one. Brazil has one. India just passed one in recent months. China has one. So most of the world is moving towards data privacy regulation. Oh, and here's a statistic I can share with you. I find this very interesting. Gartner has a statistic that as of the end of 2023, okay, so just a few months ago, more than 60%, I think the number that they use is 63% of the world's population now lives in a jurisdiction with a data privacy law like GDPR. Really? Maybe different from GDPR, but yeah, right. This style of privacy law. So I mean, what does that mean? I look at it and I see that the future of the internet and the future of data-driven business is data processing with privacy in place. Mm-hmm. You're not just going to be able to take your consumer's data and sell it anymore. Now you're going to have to follow these rules of the road. And as a result, I see transformation in the way that businesses build data-driven business models. The model isn't going to be anymore, my consumer's data is my product, unless the consumer opts into that monetization of their data. And that's a totally different concept of the business model.
So when you, I mean, it's an extraordinary opportunity that you're capitalizing on. But when you sell this, David, you go to a corporation, you knock on the door and say, we want to talk to you. I guess some people are coming to you through word of mouth, but who do you talk to? You don't talk to the IT manager, the privacy guy, the compliance gal. You have to talk to all of them.
You do have to talk to all of them. And there's a good point in that, Peter, which is that privacy touches all aspects of a business because data touches all aspects of the business. And privacy, you know, one way to think about privacy is businesses are going to be responsible for tracking all the data they collect about their consumers from start to finish across the data lifecycle. So in that data lifecycle, somewhere is all of your different departments, you know, all the different operational areas of a business. So it really has business-wide impact. Mm-hmm. And then to answer your question, we typically start by talking with a compliance department or a risk department, and then obviously the data department, because we approach this as a data management challenge.
Yep.
How do we solve these? How do we take an existing data system, or more likely than not, data systems that comprise the data practices of a business and bring them into compliance with the GDPR standards, or the one that may be familiar to US listeners is the California standard, the California Consumer Privacy Act, CCPA. So our approach is to help businesses meet them where they are, take existing data systems, and then add in the privacy controls and tracking and so forth that you need to be able to report to regulators, to respond to consumer requests like the privacy requests we talked about before, and basically to stand up a privacy program.
So how is that received by them? It doesn't sound like you talk about distributed ledger technology, blockchain, crypto. You go there, look, we provide a solution, and how we do it is kind of secret business for us.
Yeah, I don't typically talk about distributed ledger. It's somewhere in our marketing materials. It doesn't come up all the time because most of our customers right now and partners are banks and financial companies. Mm-hmm. So there has been some sensitivity in the past around the word blockchain. Now, yeah. I think it's undeserved because blockchain doesn't mean crypto. Of course, that's what people most naturally associate blockchain with, is crypto use cases. And there's no crypto in our tech stack. We don't do anything with digital securities. We use a blockchain or distributed ledger. We have a few different instances of it, which we use for the audit trail. And the value proposition that we provide with distributed ledger tech in PrivacyLock is a single source of truth, mm-hmm, for regulatory compliance. It's a source of truth that can be shared from to the business, to the regulator, and to the consumers who are part of the privacy compliance process.
So here, I'm going to get a little bit into the weeds a little bit because it intrigues me. So the technology that you use, does it sit on a public blockchain or does it run independently? So it runs like a private blockchain.
Yeah, the three different instances that we've used for distributed ledger tech in PrivacyLock are all permissioned blockchains.
Permission blockchain. So it's only as fully distributed as the number of nodes that you're using. So it's not fully decentralized until you get enough clients, I guess, on it. So if I wanted to run a node to support your network, have you incentivized node runners? Have you thought about that?
These are two excellent questions. So you're absolutely right. It's a distributed model at the moment with the ability to become decentralized. But to do decentralization, and you hit the nail on the head, we need our partners, our customers, and our community to also run nodes on their own. Now, the challenge is if we don't have crypto to incentivize people to release nodes, there's a much less attractive incentive for people to run nodes. Mm. So far, you know, we offer this to all of our customers and partners. So far, we don't have any takers of running their own nodes. And I think part of that is a technical hurdle. Blockchain technology, it's not click and play. We're not quite there yet with blockchain technology. So it's not easy to run a node. It requires compute power. There's an expense attached to it.
Absolutely.
You have technical know-how. And in my experience, nobody's really solved this problem yet. I mean, you can go read everybody's website and they'll tell you they've solved interoperability. They've solved, you can spin up a node and like it's nobody's problem. I have yet to see either one of those come to fruition.
This episode is sponsored by 3P Legal. I've been a customer of Peter North as my lawyer and now 3P Legal for over a decade. Peter and his team are friendly and approachable, which takes the stress out of having to navigate the complexities of legal business matters. Whether starting a business, buying or selling a business, handling contracts or estate planning, their personalized attention and quality of work is second to none. Find Peter and his team at www.3pcorp.com.au or email pnorth@3plegal.com.au if you need commercial or personal legal services, particularly if you're a startup. Do you have a self-managed superannuation fund that holds Bitcoin or other digital assets? Leveraging DAX's unique technology, DAX Digital Attestation Report simplifies your SMSF audit compliance, divorce, or other dispute resolutions. Recognized by Australian auditors and adhering to regulatory standards, their report extends beyond audits to offer decisive evidence in disputes. Prioritizing your privacy and security, DAX simplifies digital asset management and provides peace of mind. Their advanced technology ensures a straightforward approach to complex issues from audit protection to legal dispute evidence. Enhance your digital asset management and dispute resolution with DAX innovative solutions. If you are an SMSF trustee, accountant or auditor, or have a dispute regarding digital assets like Bitcoin, contact DAX today at hello@dax.io. That's hello@dax.io or call 1-300-346-495 or go to their website dax.io. Yeah, agreed. Absolutely agreed. And this startup that I'm working on, I've got the same thing that I'm looking at. I haven't even thought that I've solved it. I know what I want to do, but I just don't know how. Maybe a conversation for another time.
Just to kind of like drive that point home, I come at this from an experience where, you know, in our Penta days, we built and ran our own nodes, but of course we have run Ethereum nodes and experimented with running, you know, Bitcoin nodes, and we've done stuff with Polkadot and a bunch of chains. So we did a whole deep dive into Solana. So we've done all kinds of things with all kinds of nodes, and I'm telling you, the technology is not easy. You have to have a lot of know-how, and you have to have resources to run the nodes.
But you also have to have an economic model that works. You have to have an incentive program that ties into how the tech works. So Schnurdberger can go, I'm going to grab a Raspberry Pi, I'm going to plug it into my network, I'm going to run the software, and because of the effort and the use of electricity and my providing another node on the network, I get X. It costs me Y, I get X. X is greater than Y, so therefore, this is a good thing.
You're right. And the economic incentive of cryptocurrency is, I think, what really made, you know, crypto become the first killer app, as we were saying before. Mm. But here's where I see a possibility for the use of blockchain in reg tech and in regulatory workflows. And this is speculative, so take it with a grain of salt. But I think that we can build better businesses and a better internet if there's more trust in data. So from you know, the very highest level, what we're talking about here is not solving problems in the banking system and financial assets by disintermediating them, which we kind of mentioned before.
Yep.
We're talking about solving data trust problems. And coming back to my paradigm from earlier, when you have more machines talking to more machines, making decisions for consumers, that data trust is essential. And regulators and regulations come into the story. So I think there's a possibility where regulators and consumer advocacy groups and industry associations can be the ones that are incentivized to run nodes themselves.
Right. Oh, interesting.
Not because they're deriving necessarily financial benefit in the form of like a cryptocurrency.
Stakeholders.
But they're the stakeholders. The incentive is to build trust. And what do industry associations and consumer advocacy groups sell? Really, they're selling trust, they're selling know-how, and they're selling best practices. Yep. So the best practice here is to have a single source of truth that everybody can rely on for trusted data.
Yeah, right on. And that's, I think, the bit that the average Joe does not understand. That the distributed ledger technology can deliver you a single source of truth where there is consensus across the network. I'm gesticulating now. My Greekness is coming out. I find a lot of people don't understand what I mean ultimately it is about a single source of truth. That's why Bitcoin's so powerful, and because it's so completely decentralized now and hack proof. But you're right. Delivering a single source of truth allows you then to have trust in the system, and it's only the consensus protocols that allow you to do that, and the distributed ledger, as long as it's big enough.
Could I play devil's advocate just for a moment, Peter?
Go.
I'll preface by saying I'm a big fan of the Bitcoin project and I trade Bitcoin, but I would argue it's not as decentralized as we would like to think that
really?
It is.
Yeah.
And there's a number of reasons for that. With Bitcoin, for example, 51% of the network can determine, the validity of a block and approve a block essentially. And without getting too much into the weeds, there's more power concentrated in the hands of a smaller number of whales than we'd like to admit. Now, that being said, Bitcoin is the most decentralized platform probably so far of the blockchain era. And I only say this to highlight the fact that if we think about blockchains and distributed ledger technologies for data, when we're talking about data trust, it's essential that we don't give certain organizations or certain agencies undue power to control the narrative of what's the single source of truth there. So we really have to think about, we have to think about how to build systems where everybody has accountability and visibility into data and decisions that are derived from that data in a way that is equitable and decentralized. So decentralization, in a way, I guess the point I'm driving at, it becomes extremely important, not just when we think about financial assets,
right,
but for data.
Yep. There is an extraordinary, I won't call it a book, it's actually a thesis by a guy, Major Lowry from the US Space Command. He was on a podcast, What Bitcoin Did, that I listened to, and he blew my mind. But interestingly, the Bitcoin guys didn't get it. And he has an order of magnitude new perspective on the Bitcoin as a defense mechanism for national defense. I recommend you read it. It's called Soft War. I'm about 20% into it, and every time I read it, I sort of end up my jaw drops open, and how interesting his perspective is on a non-financial use case for distributed technology, specifically Bitcoin itself, because of particular attributes that it's got. Major Lowry, I'm sure is his name, and I think you can get it on Amazon. Again, I'm getting a piece of the action, so he's going for it.
That sounds interesting, and I don't know if his argument is specific to Bitcoin, but I think tokenization of data, tokenization of information, is an important contribution that distributed ledger technology has made to the Web3 movement, if you will. And I think we're going to see more use cases for tokenization, whether or not the tokenization is, cryptocurrency, or if it's just tokenizing information without the kind of element.
I think that's a whole other podcast that I would love to do with you at some point if I can wrangle you. I think we should. From an entrepreneurial point of view, you're dealing with extraordinary complexity, and I guess values that you've got, and a perspective that you've got, because you've got such a deep and broad understanding, not only of finance, regulations, the economy, and the technology that underpins it in the DeFi world, and bringing that to market presents some serious challenges. So at the moment, it sounds like, excuse me, at the moment, it sounds like you're going to them really with solutions to things that are necessary because of regulation. And so it should be a no-brainer for them to understand that you can provide solutions. I'm imagining that your competitors who can't go to them with, say, Web 2 type solutions are coming in with the same, possibly the same words. How do you differentiate your approach versus the sort of traditional approach to reg tech? Do you open your rope and go, we're using DLT? You mentioned it somewhere deep in your collateral there. And does that make the difference, or is it your ability to articulate what the problems are and then provide them comfort to the solution, so before they get the checkbook out or the receiving invoice?
I don't see it as a selling point, to be honest. So it is something that differentiates us from our competitors. And every now and then, somebody who's read our materials will say, "Oh, you know," usually somebody from the data team,
right,
who is passionate or interested in blockchain technology, will bring it up and we'll talk about it. But I haven't found it to be a selling point. Now, maybe that'll change in the future. But what people do care about when it comes to compliance is automation. And you know, I can argue that we provide better automation than our competitors. And one of the reasons is that we use a blockchain. So we track compliance workflows. Everything that we run, as far as compliance goes, and when I'm talking about a source of truth, we audit it on a blockchain. So the blockchain performs auditing functions, but it also performs automation functions.
Right.
So once you have turned compliance workflows into transactions in blockchain language, then you can build automation services off of those transactions. That's in a way how our system works. So the automation is a selling point. The robust auditing capability is a selling point. But explaining that we use blockchain is a means to an end. It's the technical solution we've chosen to provide those things. Mm-hmm. But when I'm selling the product, what I'm getting on the other end of the table is, okay, what we care about is, do we have to hire more staff to deal with new compliance?
Right.
Or do we use a tool like yours to automate? So it's efficiency gains, it's cost savings. And of course, we're talking about regulations, it's risk mitigation.
Sure.
Am I able to, you know, what's the cost if I don't comply? If I do comply, how much am I saving myself? And what's our third party risk? So something we deal with a lot in financial services is exploring what it means from a third party risk vantage point.
Yeah, right on. Business is not that hard. You can have all sorts of demand drivers in consumer, B2C, but business is only three things: more money in, less money out, and risk. Pick two. And you got a business. If you can solve, you got a business. Pick two. Pick one, you still got a business. So for Privacy Lock, I presume you're still early days at this stage, but what does the future look like in terms of a commercial venture? Are you still raising capital? Are you thinking about an exit one day, or just going to grow as much as you can and have a business that's, you know, 10x the size that it is now? What's the plan, Stan?
We look at privacy and we see a new industry.
Yep.
And it's not just about compliance. I think compliance is maybe the first domino to fall. But privacy is an emerging industry. And like I said earlier, I think the future of data processing is processing with privacy. Now think about what that means in a world with AI.
Right.
An interesting thing to share with your listeners is that under laws like the California Consumer Privacy Act, GDPR, in my home state of Colorado, we have a Colorado Privacy Act. These laws generally stipulate that derivative data sets, data derived from consumer data that comes in at data collection, but then is put through an AI model, for example, or a neural network, and spits out information that you can use to better understand your customers. You know, we can call this business intelligence or analytics. In a compliance context, it's often called profiling, which is a compliance term.
Right.
Profiling data is still subject to compliance requirements. So what that means is, in a world of AI, and everybody I talk to wants to bring AI into their business model, the data outputs of AI models, you still have to build your privacy compliance around that. So the future of data processing is processing of privacy, and that extends to AI and ML type data processing.
Wow.
So that's a really important thing to think about, because as we move into this Web3 era, and I'm thinking that AI is an important technology that's going to be, you know, a definitive technology in that era, it's not going to happen without privacy controls built in. So I see this industry emerging globally, worldwide, where people have to rethink their data business, their data-driven business models, the data infrastructure they use, because standard database technologies, proprietary technology, CRMs, which by the way are a big risk area for privacy, these were not built with privacy controls in place. So one way that we are looking to grow is by embedding privacy controls into existing infrastructure systems and enable people to stand up privacy compliance as painlessly as possible.
Right.
So I see a lot of growth opportunities there. There's a whole other conversation, maybe for another podcast, about an emerging area of the privacy industry, which is called privacy enhancing technologies, PETs.
Right. And
these are ways to abstract data, de-identify data,
right,
ways to encrypt data so that you can, in a way, skirt some of the compliance obligations, but within the rules of the frameworks,
mm-hmm,
or simply just to further mitigate the risk of having data, sensitive information that's processed, connected back to the consumer. And I'll give you an example of privacy enhancing technology: synthetic data.
Right.
And where there's some research out there that suggests that, especially with AI, and AI being a key demand driver here, by the end of the decade, 2030, so not so many years away, most processing may be using synthetic data as opposed to real human data. And whether or not that's true, I don't know. That's what the research suggests.
How do you define synthetic data? Sorry.
Synthetic data could be data that is data sets that are created and modeled based on real or perceived data sets.
Okay.
But that aren't specifically connected to an individual consumer or specifically connected to data that's been collected. So I'm sure you can imagine different ways to generate synthetic data sets. There are questions of data quality, because the same research that suggests we'll see this explosion in synthetic data also suggests that synthetic data may not have the same quality or value as human-generated data, because synthetic data can, especially as you put it through more modeling, it can lose its referential value, mm-hmm, meaning its value back to the original data inputs, which is where the initial value came in. So this is like a whole topic for something else, but synthetic data is a version of privacy-enhancing technology. Encryptions, zero-knowledge proof. There's a whole part of this industry that's looking at how do we work with data in the generation of AI.
You're right. You're right in the eye of the tornado. When you talk to your investors, because I think you've got investors in your business, yeah?
Yeah, we actually closed our first formal investment round just earlier this year.
Okay, congrats. So awesome.
Thank you.
Awesome. When you explain this to them, what's the question here I'm trying to ask? My experience has been that there's a serious gap between their understanding of the digital decentralized world and your understanding of the digital decentralized world. They have capital they want to allocate, and they want to mitigate the risks, or at least understand the risks that they're taking, so they can make a determination on how much of your business they're going to want in return for that risk. And they can only, there's just no way they will be as deeply in the weeds and understand it as much as you do. How do you bridge that gap?
Well, first of all, that's good, by the way, because if they understood my product and industry better than me, they probably wouldn't want to invest in me to begin with. But let me start by saying this. It's really hard to raise capital right now. I don't know what you're seeing in Australia, but you know, in the United States, I think what happened was during the zero interest rate period, the very low interest rates that we had for a long time, money was essentially free. It had a very low cost attached to it for financial companies. So they were able to acquire capital at very little to no cost. And then they had to deploy the capital. So one of the places they deployed was into the startup space, and venture capital was just cutting checks left and right without too much concern for the valuations that they were agreeing to with these companies when they invested in them. And then all of a sudden, the COVID pandemic happens, inflation kicks up. We're all seeing this to some degree across the world. And the Silicon Valley Bank was the other shoe that fell. So we had in this country the failure of the Silicon Valley Bank. And Silicon Valley Bank was a huge bank for startups that were invested in putting their capital there. They worked with a lot of venture funds. And when Silicon Valley Bank went down, I think, this combined with the higher rate environment that we see here in the US, it kind of just took the punch bowl away from the party in a way, and has sort of brought people back to fundamentals as sobering moments tend to do. And people realize that, oh, well, these valuations aren't sustainable. They're way up in the clouds. They're not down to earth.
Right.
And they kind of came back to fundamentals about, what is looking at your actual sales, your run rates, and all these kinds of fundamental metrics. A lot of businesses that raised during that period, even if they've been doing well and successful, are now having to go through down rounds because it's just so hard to get access to capital, and people are much more aggressive on the investment side of the table about valuations. So this is what I see coming out of the Silicon Valley Bank failure and the increased, the higher rate environment that we live in. It's really changed the investment theses for venture groups and maybe the sensibilities of angel investors too, who maybe aren't as freewheeling with their capital as they were in the zero rate environment.
Yeah.
So this has created a challenging environment to raise in. So, in our experience, and I've seen other companies are raising smaller rounds at lower valuations. And that's sort of where I see the market
than the previous one that they had gone to.
Well, if they had raised before in that previous environment, then sometimes what they're experiencing is a down round where they're having to reduce their valuation because their valuation is coming back down to earth, right? It's up in the clouds. It's got to come back down to earth. And if they want to raise their next round, which is probably going to be a sizable round, then they have to make it work for their investors. So coming back to your initial question, I want everybody to have that environment in mind, because that's what I see as the environment right now. It's a challenging environment to raise in. And you have to be able to sell your business model to them based on their investment thesis. Mm-hmm. So, venture capital funds are meeting dozens of businesses a week, maybe even in a single day. And maybe one of them is in the privacy industry, and 10 are payment solutions to banks and financial companies. And other ones are, the next right. 10 are blockchain or Web3 enabled companies. They probably see all kinds of things, and catching their attention is challenging. And you have to be able to show that you have something different.
Yep.
For us, the good news is that privacy is this new industry, and we entered the industry relatively early. So that was benefit for us. And then, showing people that we had a unique approach to what we were doing. Our big differentiator, and I didn't answer this before when we were talking about blockchain differentiation, but our biggest differentiator is not that we use blockchain per se. It's how we use it.
Right.
What we do with our blockchain is we utilize a privacy by design approach, which is actually a GDPR term. It's a compliance term, and it's about building data systems and data tools that have privacy controls built in. So even our own privacy tools have privacy built into it. And what that means is when we help people map their data and manage their data inventory, which is a critical part of standing up a data privacy program, because you have to know what you've collected, you have to know how you're processing
it.
In order to deal with these compliance requirements. We do this without collecting any consumer data. That's our secret sauce. So we help businesses to map their data, to understand their data processing activities, to understand their exposure and data sharing relationship with their vendors. We don't ever collect any of the customer data. And the blockchain is central to how we accomplish that. But what I'm selling to folks is the fact that we help them implement privacy compliance with smart automation without collecting their customer data. And that's what sells. Not explaining to them in the weeds how we do it with blockchain technology.
So you tell them the time, don't tell them how the clock works.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know if that is true for everybody, but that's certainly true for me. Now, there are those investors, there are those buyers when we're talking about a sales cycle who are more technically savvy and who want to get deep into the weeds and understand how it works.
Right.
And then sometimes, you know, blockchain is a flashy item to talk to them about.
You take them into a skiff, lower the cone of silence, hold one of their children hostage and tell them all about it. Fantastic.
Well, look, I agree. I'll be totally honest with you about something. We debate, and we haven't made a final decision about this. You know, our IP is, we protect our IP. It's unique to Privacy Lock. But we do talk about this sort of Web3 build a community concept where we can make a portion of it open source and invite other people and engage a community to develop on top of it, because it's silly to think that nobody has the answers to every problem and nobody's going to be able to solve everything. So what's great about crypto blockchains is that they've incentivized developers to come together to solve problems, to fix bugs and do all that. So I think there's a possibility where we can explore that opportunity in this emerging privacy industry space.
So that's interesting. Excuse me again. So how would you facilitate? So you've built your tech. It's a private blockchain. I get it. Would you take an instance of that and then release it on GitHub as open source, or would you repurpose it somehow? That you remove things that you think are critical to your business and then let it fly and see what happens. How would you do that? Because it's a conversation that we've had too in our business. What part this should be? This should be a public block, open source approach, at least in part. And then I go, okay, that sounds great, but what do I do?
Yeah, and hopefully my investors aren't, you know, freaking out right now and falling over their chairs, because obviously we have to protect the critical IP and maintain that as a business in order to grow and to demonstrate our value as a business. So I think what comes out of that is obviously you can build APIs, you can build an API layer, you can build SDKs that doesn't give away the core innovation and the core technology, which for us is a combination of the audit engine, which has all of this automation built into it. And again, the blockchain is kind of the key technical piece that mediates a lot of that and executes a lot of that, technically speaking. And the mapping tool, which of course is connected with our blockchain technology, but we map without collecting data, and we build a map that's operational, so you can run automation workflows using that map once you've mapped. And so thinking about those critical technologies that we've developed, and of course, and we have a whole toolkit that is responsive to compliance requirements under GDPR, CCPA, and so on. We have a cookies, we do our own cookies tool and cookie scanner,
right,
the whole gamut, and data subject request processes. But when I look at the core technology, how would we develop that into a Web3 community-driven approach? And I think part of that is building an API layer. where people can access the auditing capabilities and the mapping capabilities without owning them.
Right.
But they can extend them. And so I think there's something beautiful about, and we talk about this all the time, you can build technology that solves a specific problem in a specific way, but it's only going to work for that specific use case.
Right.
Or you can take that specific problem and identify a general problem and build a general architecture, technical architecture that solves the problem. And that's the second camp is where we always try to be in, because that's the only way to scale.
Yeah, sure.
And I think that then going back to the more specific use cases, if you've built that more general solution and you can build and you can encourage people and invite people to build on top of it to solve those more specific, more narrow use cases, then that is also a way to build a community.
Sure, sure. You become an essential component potentially of your competitor's solution.
Yeah, so you provide the engine or the virtual machine. Which that's probably not technically correct. Sorry about that. But then you inspire people to build on top of it to run their own businesses. Because think about all the people who build websites. And now they need to think about, oh, well, do I need to build in cookies tracking to this website? Because the customer in GDPR, they're doing business in California and so on.
Right.
Do I need to provide, oh, I'm building a data system or I'm managing the database on behalf of this company. Do I need to map this data, manage an inventory, and be able to respond to protected consumer privacy requests under these legal frameworks? And these are questions that I think businesses haven't really encountered yet, but they're starting to, and they're going to see more of it.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's a really good place to stop, David. Thank you so much for sharing your journey today and getting into the weeds with me on the crypto stuff. That's been fantastic. Maybe tell people a little bit about how to contact Privacy Lock and where they can go to find out some more information.
Yeah, thank you so much for the opportunity to connect with you today, Peter. It was fun. I enjoyed the back and forth and definitely enjoyed talking about the crypto and decentralization pieces as well. So thank you so much for this opportunity and for the great podcast. For your listeners, if you'd like to learn more about Privacy Lock, please come visit our website at myprivacylock.io.
Okay. All right. And they can take it from there. Okay, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with David Ritter. I really had a good time talking to David, and there's so much more that we could talk about. I will definitely try and get him back on the show, but for the moment, please take care of yourself, and we'll see you next time on Entrepreneurship with Christo.